Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Being a lone wolf in the music business is dangerous. Like, you won't last long if you don't have affiliations.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 108, a talk with J-Zone. J-Zone Mumford is a rapper, producer, musician, and author whose ability to find and chop the perfect sample is paired with a rap persona that combines two Live Crew-style raunchiness, self-deprecating humor, pointed social observations and commentary, and a deep love for all of rap history, including some of its most bizarre corners. And naturally, there's an alter ego who just happens to be a 4'3" baseball bat-wielding rodent named Chief Chinchilla. J-Zone started his rap career as an audio engineer, working under Vance Wright, best known as Slick Rick's DJ. Jay's first album, Music for Tu Madre, began life as a college senior project, but quickly caught on with the underground scene. He then released a ton of albums, with his old maid billionaire's crew of Huggy and Al-Sheed, solo, with collaborators like Self-Titled, and even a duet album of malt liquor jingles with Chief Chinchilla. But by 2009, he was noticing diminishing returns financially and creatively, and decided to get out of the rap game. He wrote about his career ups and downs in a 2011 memoir called Root for the Villain, Rap, Bullshit, and a Celebration of Failure. In a somewhat ironic turn of events, the book received great reviews and love from music industry movers and shakers like Questlove, Chuck D, and RJD2. The topics J-Zone wrote about in the book's essays also inspired him to create his first new solo album in 9 years, 2013's Peter Pan Syndrome. Recently, he's also taken up the drums, recording an album of vintage-sounding drum grooves called Lunch Breaks. When we sat down with him, he had just finished teaching a class on the history of recorded music at SUNY Purchase. If you like The Cypher and want to see it continue, consider making a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. We even have special rewards and experiences for our donors. Also, make sure to find us on iTunes. From there, you can rate, review, and subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can find a list of songs heard on today's show, as well as all of our back episodes, at thecyphershow.com. And now, here's Tweety Bird Loke's biggest fan, J-Zone. Funk was kind of what, even before hip hop, you were.
Yeah, and no, I started funk. That was my thing. Records my parents had, looking at the album covers, like the peacock madness of the album covers and the outfits. And I'm an only child, so I didn't have brothers and sisters like, yo, you can't walk around in no spacesuit like that. So I'd be in like third or fourth grade, like, yeah, I want to get me a spacesuit. Knowing these records are like 10 years old at the time. And like, that's not what kids my age were listening to or wearing.
People weren't messing with.
Yeah. So it would be like 1986. And I'm looking at outfits that like Parliament and Slave had on with bell bottoms. Like, yeah, I'm going to get that. A big ass fro. It's like 86. Everybody else got like leathers and fedoras and the Run DMC thing. And I missed that whole, I knew who they were, but I missed that whole thing.
Yeah.
Like I was stuck in funk. And then, you know, I got into hip hop because I recognized the samples and the beats. Even back then as a kid, I used to be a bass player. So I would buy records to practice my bass to mimic the bass lines.
What kind of bass players did you, who were your favorites?
My favorite was a guy named Mark Adams from Slave. Mm-hmm. He's underrated. He passed about 4 years ago, but if you listen to any of Slave's stuff, you'll be like, how? I mean, he's just the, I guess they call him accidentals, or all the harmonic, all the stuff he used to do. He was like the Jaco Pastorius of funk. He was the best bass player, in my opinion, for that, you know, for funk. It's just my favorite period. But, you know, like, you know, Stanley Clarke. You know, my dad got me into jazz, so you like Jimmy Garrison with the upright. You know, some simple funk stuff like Kool from Kool and the Gang. And, you know, the regulars, Bootsy Collins, Fred Thomas, Bernard Odom.
Right.
Marshall Jones from Ohio Players. All the standard funk bassists, everybody who was standard, you know, but Mark Adams was my guy. I was like, he's playing that thing like a lead guitar, man.
Which is kind of the opposite approach from a lot of, other than Bootsy, a lot of the James Brown people.
They were pocket. Yeah. Just you know, because it was more about the drummer, at least in the 60s, it was more about Clyde and those guys. And, you know, the bass came more to the forefront after James Jamerson, basically. You know, Motown, the way he was like Bernadette and stuff like that, the way he's playing the lines. In the 70s, especially with disco, the bass lines got more elaborate and the drums became stationary, whereas with funk, the drums are more polyrhythmic and the bass kind of just locks in, so they kind of switch roles. But I mean, even as a kid, I was aware of all that stuff just because that was what my musical education was, just like funk and then stuff. My dad had rock stuff because he went to Southern Illinois University and his roommates were all like white guys in the rock. And he's a kid from, black kid from Brooklyn in the jazz. So he came back from college and, you know, he had records like Cream and, you know, Keith Hartley Band and, you know, the Jack Bruce, like all that stuff. And then, you know, his jazz and his rock background and my mother with the funk records. I had a wild mix of records in the house growing up.
Yeah. And I was curious about that because, like, with the James Brown stuff we were talking about, you took up drums a couple of years ago,
right.
I know, and like were sort of inspired by that sort of mid-60s James Brown drummers.
Mm-hmm.
Did you hear, and obviously all those drum breaks everyone's familiar with from sort of the mid, you know, from the golden age hip-hop records. You got a drum! Did you hear their play, and you were super familiar with their playing, did you hear their playing differently after you started playing drums?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because you are, when you're sampling something, you just have like, you have no idea what it's like to play that. And then, you know, it's like, for instance, one break I always say is "You'll Like It Too" by Funkadelic. Everybody's used it. It's the intro to "I Know You Got Soul." It's been a long time. I shouldn't have left you without a strong rhyme to step to. Think of how many weeks shows you slept through. Time's up. I'm sorry I kept you. But when you sit down and try to play, you just realize like the swing and the way the hi-hat is. I mean, some serious chops behind that stuff, you know. So, and just, it changed the way I listen to records. Like, I don't care what kind of music it is, I always listen to the drums first. Like, now when something comes on, I listen to what the drummer's doing to try to learn from it, you know, especially if it's another style of music I'm not used to playing. Like, I'll be in the gym and they'll play like some crappy EDM or some just regular pop or whatever through the gym speakers, and I'll be listening, is that a drum machine or is that a drummer? Okay, what is he doing, you know? And just, I'm like a sponge now. So like anytime I hear something, I always listen for the drummer first, and I approach it from that perspective, like how they played it. So I just have a greater respect for it because I know how difficult it is to learn that stuff. And I also have a greater appreciation for like mistakes. I notice Like a lot of those guys, a lot of those records we love, like if you try to loop more than one bar, mm-hmm. it won't be a perfect BPM and it'll drift. You got to chop it. And it's like, because they weren't really playing the click tracks back then. They were just jamming and, you know, there would be mistakes. You couldn't have Pro Tools to clean up a take. Like, you know, so now you listen carefully and you can hear like the mistakes. And I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I was listening to, I think, The Grunt last night.
Oh, and God, the trumpets like flub notes.
There's like a drop beat or something about like a minute and a half in.
Yeah, there's drop beats and, you know, that they don't hit the snare the same way every time. And it's kind of raw. But that's to me, like, when I started playing drums and studying and listening to drums, I started noticing some of those inconsistencies, but I'm like, that makes it dope. Like, that's unpredictable. And like, hip hop is such a sequence based, repetition based, editing based music, especially since technology's improved. I mean, because, like, you know, if you listen like in the 80s, you listen to Slick Rick Children's Story. My mentor, Vance Wright, was Rick's DJ. Those guys flew that stuff in by hand. So when you try to blend the beginning of Children's Story, you can't because it drags. It's like, dude. It doesn't drop perfectly because a lot of that stuff was done by hand. Or you listen to like old school ED, you listen to PSK, and when the beat comes out, it doesn't come right back in perfectly. But I like that, like the end of Criminology, Raekwon, where the drums just go way off.
RZA would do, we were talking to Paul about that, RZA would do, you know, snares and pretty much everything by hand the whole way through.
Yeah, he would do it by hand. And when I started playing drums, I really began to appreciate, I mean, Dilla did that too, like the human error. They would put human error where perfection was standard.
Yeah,
you're dealing with sequencing, MPCs, Pro Tools, Ableton, whatever you're using, and everything is a grid and it's made to perfection. And like when you have guys working in that medium who can put human feel and mistakes into it, I think that's genius.
Yeah, we had Gabriel Roth on the show, who was the co-founder of Daptone,
right.
Daptone Records. And he was saying that like one of the things drum machines did was like codified swing, right? Every swing, you can set the percentage of how something
yeah.
swings and it stays that way through the whole thing. And you don't have this like, you know, feel where like, you know, like you're saying, it's swinging yay much in one bar and then a little more, a little less, you know, somewhere else in the song.
Yeah, that's and any human is going to like, there's going to be mild, slight vary. I mean, you know, guys like Steve Gadd can play like a drum machine. But if you listen to Substitution, like when I was trying to replay that, the first bar, those 16th notes on the bass drum are straight. Boom, 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 gah. And the second bar, boom, 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 gah. They swing a little closer. Was the drummer, or I think it might have been Bernard Perry, but I'm not sure. Was the drummer thinking about that? I'm going to swing. I'm going to keep the first bar straight, swing it. No, he was just playing. But if you loop two full bars of that, you get that kind of mixture going on. And I didn't realize that, even though I was, you know, pretty savvy with my production from a technical side, I didn't really begin to appreciate that until I started playing the drums. When I would record myself and there would be mistakes and inconsistencies, a lot of times I just leave it in. I wouldn't fix it. I'd be like, it sounds better. I meant to rim shot. I clicked it instead, but it sounds good like that when I don't hit the snare right.
Yeah.
It kind of sounds cool. So I started to get an appreciation of mistakes and realize how difficult it is to play perfectly. So when I watch guys like Steve Gadd or Steve Ferrone or guys who are like human drum machines, it just makes me appreciate that skill.
The sense of time with drummers is so crazy. I remember seeing Dennis Chambers give a clinic years ago, and he just like, he was playing a solo and he just sat out and sat out and sat out. And you were like, what, did he stop playing? Like, what happened? Like, it was a really long time. And then he came back in and it was like right on beat. And it was, you know, it was solo performance. He had no idea how he managed to keep time that consistently his head that long.
Yeah, it's a freakish skill that I'm still trying to learn. It's just very tough to learn that. It's like a body motion thing. It's a feel thing. You know, there's beauty in all of it. The imperfections, the perfections, it's all part of playing. It's just using it in a musical situation, like knowing when to use what.
Yeah. And so you did an album of drum breaks, right? Some, yeah, you know, sort of your gloss on famous breaks, some original stuff.
Yeah, Lunch Breaks. It came out last year, and it did really well. I was surprised, you know. But I think a lot of that, I was still learning at that time. I think a lot of it was because I got the sound of the drums. I learned how to mic them and record them and set them up. I studied vintage drums and recording and mics for a few years, just like constant study and trial and error and research. And figured out how to get drums to sound like what we want to sample. And because I was a sampling producer for so long, I know how to do that. Like, you'll have a lot of drummers who are much better than me, like great skillful drummers that'll make breakbeat CDs and they show off their chops, but they're using like this guitar centered modern kit with plastic heads and they're miking every drum close. And it's like, you know, it's like it's freakish drumming, but then it's like, it doesn't sound like what we used to sample. So I think coming from a sampling background, I know what it's supposed to sound like. So it's just a matter of me being able to play what I'm hearing, what I'm feeling, and getting it to sound that way. So that was an experience. It made me a better musician, definitely.
There were some live drums on your last studio album, right, on Peter Pan?
I played about 90% of those, yeah.
Nice. That record, I guess we can, you know, sort of start there talking about your music. You'd been off from music for a while, and then you wrote a book. Was Peter Pan Syndrome, like a lot of the songs on that are sort of glosses on stuff you covered in your book, Root for the Villain. Was it inspired by the book?
Absolutely. I just think when I wrote the book, I was at a very odd crossroads, something where I looked at all my peers and nobody else seemed to be going through the same thing. So I kind of felt I was all alone, you know, and I wrote it in a book, but then there were certain things that I said that would make a great song. And I said, I don't want to stop there. Like the book, I covered so much ground that I didn't really have time to remain on the most interesting topic, which was life as a musician. When things don't work out, what happens?
Right.
And that's something that up till now, we have the internet to bring these stories. You know, people get on Medium or you'll see like Q-Point articles about it or blog posts about it. But in the past, it was a mystery. Like artists came and went, and we never knew. Did they go get standard 9-to-5 jobs? Do they work behind the scenes? Are they destitute? We didn't know. So that was the most interesting dynamic of the book to me. Like, okay, the music thing didn't work out, you know, financially. Like all things come to an end. What's next? But then I glossed over that and I moved on to other things in the book. So when I did the album, I was like, let me just take a snapshot of that particular concept and build a whole album around it and just put it to music. Like, okay, you pour everything you got into this. Your friends are all married, kids, mortgages, you know, 401ks or whatever. And you're sitting here, you're kind of like, you're trying to get a job and you can't find a job because you have no experience in that. Your resume says old man entertainment.
Right. People are like, so, what's that?
Or, yeah, yeah. You know, I couldn't find like a standard job. I maxed out at about $12 an hour. And then you're working at a place, you know, you're not making any money, you have multiple jobs, you're in your mid-30s, and everybody's asking, like, well, how did you end up in this spot? Like, you should be making X amount. You should be thinking about your future. You should be saving for retirement. Like, A, I can't retire, and B, saving for what? I got bills right now. And you're just like, you know, you're looking around, and you're like, is anybody else in this position? And it's almost like, damn, you're petrified of just growing up in the real world because you know that it's not the standard route that you're supposed to take as an adult. Like, you feel like you missed the boat. And people don't understand that. Like, it's easy to say, like, yo, the music didn't work out, just get a job. But it's like, if you worked in corporate America for 15 years, and then it was like, yo, just pick up a saxophone and record a jazz album. That's the equivalent of it. Like, right. You know what I'm saying? Like, I never been in a job interview in my life. So, you know, it was just scary as hell. And then I was like, well, maybe I'll just go back to school. And then this is 2008. The economy tanked. You know, I have a unique situation with my house where I couldn't take out loans. I was going to try to get school loans and I didn't qualify for loans, but I couldn't afford to pay for school. So I was like, I'm just going to have to get a crap job and work my way up. And after about 3 months, you realize that working your way up, shit, that's the 80s. Like, that doesn't work no more. I just felt stuck. And it was like, I went back to the only way I know how to express myself, you know, which is making music. And I think just learning to play the drums gave me an excitement to pursue the music again. And then the ideas from the book kind of just snowballed when I said, well, if I'm going to come back, I might not be as jokey this time around because I'm dealing with some real stuff.
The title track of the album, The Peter Pan Syndrome, is like talks about some of the stuff you just laid out.
Now here I am, 36, still living like I'm 22 and loving it. The real world is knocking at the door. In my 30s, treat it like it's a over witness and doing it. Man, fuck this. Trap career dead, can't hide, time to get a job. No experience at all in a 9-to-5. Employers talking about what I've been up to since I was 22. Making rap records, niggas trying to stay alive. Now an artist pushing 40, living check to check. But each year my peers relate to...
Right.
Was that a hard thing to record? Like, it's, you know, you sort of have a cap on it on the record, you know, you sort of joke around with your alter egos and stuff, but it is a very brutally honest song. Like, was that tough to write or tough to put out?
Yeah, it was. Whenever you take the book was actually harder than that. You know what I'm saying? Like, that was because it's the problem is, it's like you almost have to laugh at it because it's not like I'm talking about that in hindsight. I'm still living that. So you're talking about it. It's one thing to say like, yo, this happened, and like, but now everything's good. Like with the book, it was like, oh, you succeeded. You wrote a book. You survived the music business. You can move on. No, I'm still like a working musician. Like sometimes it's a feast or famine life from check to check, and money gets slow. And, you know, I don't have a family, you know, like I don't have kids or nothing like that. So it was like, but a lot of that was a decision because I'm looking at like how stable this is, you know, and job prospects and different things. So, you know, it was hard to write mostly because I was still living it I still am living it. It's easier to talk about stuff in hindsight. Yeah, I used to be a drug addict. It was tough, but now I'm not. But if you're still a drug addict, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, so that's why that was the main reason why that was difficult to write about.
Something else on that song that seems appropriate to talk about, given where we are in kind of a rapidly changing area of Harlem, you know, is the song Trespasser,
right,
which is about, you know, new arrivals in New York City and
right,
changing neighborhood names and so forth. I mean, the book right, sort of concentrates on Brooklyn, but I think it applies to parts of Manhattan as well. One thing that really stuck out to me in that song is like you talk about sort of new arrivals. They have this combination of privilege and ignorance.
Imminent domain in the game. You can't stop privilege. Add it to your ignorance. It's the reason Leon's Rib Shack became Connor and Kelly and Caitlin Chicken and Biscuits.
Damn.
And I was hoping you could expand on a bit because I thought that was like really hit the nail on the head in a lot of ways.
I just think it's like it happened. Like neighborhoods change, things change. And I'm not mad at that. I'm, you know, people moving to it happens. You know what I'm saying? My neighborhood is majority Black, you know, Caribbean. And in the 60s, it was mostly Jewish. And I'm sure people are saying, damn, Black people moving. You know, so neighborhoods change, you know, but it's just like this kind of like what bothered me the most about it is just this kind of insouciance. Like people are walking around and they don't acknowledge like, OK, you're from, you know, any city USA and you come to this city, like you don't try to bring everything with, like there are people who are still living there from before. You just kind of have to acknowledge it. So like, you know, when your trash man comes or your postman comes, like say hello. You know, the kids who live on the block, you know, they listen to their rap music, they got their pants hanging low. But if they're your neighbors, maybe you could just say hi. You know, it's kind of like I would be in parties or I'd be in neighborhoods and it was kind of like just this rift between people who are on their way out and people who are moving in. And it's just kind of like nobody's bothering to communicate, you know, and it's kind of like, and then you have people like, yeah, Brooklyn, Brooklyn. But I mean, you know, I used to hear people, you know, like, yeah, Bed-Stuy, Biggie, you know, sold drug, but you weren't there when drugs were being sold. Like, imagine living there and there's a drug den outside of your house. Like, that's not entertainment. That's real shit.
Yeah, the guy who's selling them is not a famous rapper yet.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's, I remember hearing a guy like, yo, let's move to Bed-Stuy, man, like off of Fulton, man. Like, yo, Biggie, I heard Biggie used to sell drugs. I'm like, that's not something to be brag about. You know what I'm saying? Like, there are people who died or lost what they had, or, you know, I've had a second cousin who was a crackhead. He used to come to my grandparents' house and just put his hands in the food while Christmas dinner or something. Just take his hands, working on a car, oil on his hands, put his hand in an artichoke bowl. I'm saying, and I'm like 9 years old and my mother's trying to put me in the room so I don't have to see what's going on. My grandfather had to kick him out because he's on crack. You know what I'm saying? So it's like people kind of brag about that stuff, but that was just, you know, they move into the neighborhood and they want to celebrate those aspects of it. You know, but it's really, it's just deeper than that. And like, the, it's not a harmonious, like it's a, I always say it's not a melting pot. It's like a salad, like the ingredients touch, but they don't blend. Everybody just kind of goes their own way. So this is not a harmonious mixture. They say, oh, Brooklyn is such a melting pot. It's not a melting pot, it's salad. And you go your way, I go mine. We live on the same block until someone can't afford to live there no more. And then the appearance of the block starts to change. So I'm just saying, it's, I just wanted to just shine light. It's not a harmonious existence, you know?
Yeah. And I think the song is accurate and kind of like pokes fun at people, but it's not like, I don't know, it's not exactly quite as mean-spirited as maybe you might think.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah. I mean, people, you know, people would say it's mean-spirited because of the Chief Chinchilla jokes about the crime wave.
Yo, you know what we really need?
What?
Not too long, but just a spate of purse snatchings, bike jackets for like a week. An Ed Koch era, good old Al Sharpton when he was 300 pounds in a jogging suit, and gold chains era crime week. Checks and balances for transplants, that's all.
Ignorant.
Bring back Wilding for a day.
Stuff like that. Right. That's just my mean-spirited humor.
Yeah,
that comes through. But
well, there was one line in that tune, just for one more thing about it, was like, you have that line about like half these liberals are conservatives in drag.
NYC ain't no milk pot, Ray Kelly and Bloomberg should both be shot. Silent segregation, what a nag, because half these liberals are conservatives in drag.
Yeah.
And that reminded me of like, do you know the Phil Oaks Love Me, I'm a Liberal, that song?
I'm not familiar.
Okay. I mean, basically, his point is like, it's sort of from the point of view of a liberal who is, you know, liberal on issues that are, you know, big and worldwide, but anything close to home, you know, becomes very conservative.
Yeah.
Ah, the people of old Mississippi should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. What's the matter? Don't they watch Les Crane? But if you ask me to bus my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me.
I was wondering if you meant it in that sense.
Yeah, because you have people who are like, you know, like, yeah, I love Dipset, but I don't want to live around people who look like Dipset. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, yeah, yeah, crack and Cameron. Yeah, but you wouldn't want to live around people that Cameron grew up with, you know, which is fine, but it's like, you know, I just, you know, people. That line was just about that. Like, you know, you could like Jay-Z, and Jay-Z is like that line and John Turturro and Do the Right Thing. He's talking about Prince and Eddie Murphy and Magic, and they're not like Radio Raheem and Bugging Out. They're different. Yeah, they're black, but they're more than black. It's different.
All you talk about is nigga this and nigga that. And all your favorite people are so-called niggas.
It's different. Magic, Eddie, Prince are not niggas. I mean, they're not black. I mean, let me explain myself. They're not really black. I mean, they're black, but they're not really black. They're more than black. It's different.
It's different?
Yeah, to me, it's different.
You know, deep down inside, I think you wish you were black.
Get the fuck out of here.
Laugh if you want to. You know, your hair is kinkier than mine.
It's like, it's the same thing. Yeah. So, you know, like, to me, that's, I just wanted to kind of like talk about, it just used to kind of tickle me when I used to see that. And I just wanted to talk about that.
Speaking of Jay-Z, you have Jackin' for Basquiat's
right
on that record, and kind of gloss on Ice Cube that makes fun of rappers' new obsession with with Basquiat.
We robbed the whole fucking art show. Basquiat, Warhols, Picasso's, and bag the hoes.
Y'all wanna rap about fine art? Jack them at gunpoint and hang them up in a golden cross.
Yeah, that's right. Now you can eat your beef patty and look at your Basquiat. Cause we jack it from the rich and give it back to the poor.
Yeah. What kind of got to you? What bugged you about people like Jay-Z and Swiss Beatz and this kind of mainstream?
It's just like
rapping?
That the art has become a status symbol. These guys lived in poverty. Basquiat was in Central Park. These guys were homeless at some point. And then, people take that fine art and make it a symbol of status. Like, dropping all these artists' names on a record and, take some of that money and start an art appreciation program in Marcy.
Yeah.
Go down to the local library and just say, kids are walking around quoting the lyrics from these songs, talking about Basquiat. They don't know who the hell he is. I heard a kid singing lines from Magna Carta on the train, like to himself. And he probably doesn't know who these people, start doing art appreciation program and just so they learn who these people are. And it's just like, it's a status symbol for people who just weren't getting it like that.
Yeah. A lot of your career, on the sort of the first half of your career, kind of before your temporary Jay-Z style retirement,
right,
was spent in the indie rap world. And in your book, you talk about something that I saw, playing in rock bands on kind of the indie rock side of the fence, which is that like the independent music business in a lot of cases operates like the major label
mm-hmm.
music business, just with less money.
Poor man's mainstream. Yeah. When I came in, I thought it was this kind of safe haven for creativity. Like, there's no major label politics. There's no A&R telling me what to do. I don't have to shoot a video with big butt girls. All that. That's, because you see Stretch and Bobbito and they're playing these really crazy records that are really not commercially viable, but they're dope, You go to Fat Beats and there's a record on the wall you never heard of and it gets a chance to be on the wall because of what it is. And you don't realize it. But then when you get into the game and start doing shows with people, you realize it's the same thing. Like everybody wants to, I think in beyond music and in life, people want to know what they're dealing with. People like labels. Okay, well, what does it sound like? Who is it inspired by? You go on a date, like, what do you do? What type of person? People want to know what they're dealing with so they don't have to spend time getting to know you or accepting that it's something different. So in the indie rap scene, it was the same thing. It's like, okay, well, you're sampling all this crazy stuff. So it has like this vintagey golden era thing, but you're obviously inspired by Project Pat. That's not supposed to happen in this world. It was kind of like the attitude of a Sugar Free or 3-6 Mafia record with the approach to sampling of KMD's Mr. Hood with, the wild energy of Redman. Like I love everything. I love music and hip hop. I love all stuff, Southern stuff, West Coast stuff, New York stuff, sample stuff with keyboards. I like everything. To me, good music and bad music, that's the only kind of music there is. So I kind of drew from all these different things for my inspiration. But, especially being in New York, the indie scene was very much boom bap, kind of that claw. I used to be known for not doing hooks. I just used to talk shit in between verses. And the average indie hip hop record was keep it real, represent hip hop on it, show you how we do it. And then you take a cut from either Time's Up or It Ain't Hard to Tell or Shook Ones a cappella and mix that in there. And that was the standard sound.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I'm just going to string together a bunch of weird quotes from television. Like I'll be watching Bewitched or Leave It to Beaver. And I'd be like, if I bend what Wally Cleaver says out of context, he could sound like he's a pervert. So I would put that in there and then I would like talk back and, I was just like, let me see how many rules I could bend because I'm thinking indie rap, there's no rules. And then, I would do shows and a lot of the boom bap purist types, you on that weirdo shit, son. Like, and then like a lot of the guys who were into the weird stuff, they were like, yeah, your production's cool, but why do you have to talk? Why do you have to have a song about titties? You know what I'm saying? So it was like, my content was more fitting for like some of the harder stuff, but then it was kind of goofy. So the self-effacing humor, like a lot of people didn't get that. And sonically, it was, you know, from a certain era, but then I would use like weirdo samples, but then I would use 808s. So I would take every no-no in the book and just try to make it work. I did this melting pot of influences that don't go together. And to me, it's just music. But when I'm in the, you know, I'm doing indie hip hop stuff and guys would buy beats from me, but then they didn't. I always felt like, you know, that me as an artist, like I kind of threw them off all the time. Yeah. You know, I remember one guy, I'm not going to say who he was, but he saw me in a beat battle and he was like, yo, you got some shit, but yo, man, you have a fur coat on. Like, what is this? Like, because I used to do these weird showmanship things and a lot of people just didn't get my persona.
The thing that's interesting about that is kind of like when you were a rap fan as a kid, there was far less categorization. Like you look at some of the bills. You know, we were talking to Paul about that, about the Def Jam tour in, you know, 86 or 87, whenever Stetsa was on it. And, you know, the bill was crazy. It was stuff that, you know, was all kinds of people all over the map on a bill together. But then by the time you became an artist, there was this increasing categorization.
Exactly. And I just talked about that to my class, you know, today. I was like, I remember Fresco and Miz, Ice Cube, Too Short, I think Poor Righteous Teachers, Intelligent Hoodlum. Like, you just went, yeah, I think De La and N.W.A. toured together. Because back then, it was just rap. It was just like rap. It didn't even have its own section in a record store. You go to Sam Goody, it's mixed in with R&B. So it was so small. It's like, yo, you're a jokey rapper. I'm a gangster. But so what? We stick together. It's hip-hop. We stick together.
Yeah.
You know, and I grew up watching that. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was inspired by all of that. I bought everything and everything had an impact on me and it showed up in my music, you know? So like, but by the time I became a touring artist, they're like, well, no, I'll never forget. And shout out to Slug, cause he's a really good dude. And that's my man. I remember, I'll never forget. I opened up for Atmosphere at the Knitting Factory and man, the look on those chicks' faces, because Slug was one underground guy who had women at his shows. I'm like, there ain't no women at these. And he had women. I was like, wow, there's women. And then I'm up there doing my stuff and they just look totally disgusted. And it was like, I get off stage and this chick was like, you need to listen to what Slug says because what you're saying is foul, it's disgusting, it's misogynist, it's foul. I was like, damn, like to me, it's just entertainment. Like I'm not, because I grew up watching Two Live Crew. Those guys were on Phil Donahue and the crowd is all disgusted and they're just kind of they're joking around. Like they're not taking it serious.
Yeah.
You know, but it's like, damn, I guess I can't open up for these guys no more. And I love them, but it was like, I couldn't open, you know, and I would do shows. And after a while, it was like, yo, the only way we can get a draw is if you headline. And I wasn't big enough artist to headline. So after a while, I couldn't get shows. I wasn't performing. And when I was, it was Chitlin Circuit stuff where I was losing money. And that's what kind of like started that spiral downward. You know, it was just like, I know they say, oh, touring, it's all about touring and merch. Touring, besides a couple of overseas tours, touring never worked out for me. I had a lot of bad experiences on the road, you know?
Yeah.
So I was never a big fan of doing shows.
And I know that like someone who as a teenager, preteen, whatever, kind of gave you hope was like Digital Underground, right?
Because yeah.
They were smart and funny.
Oh,
and
when, like, when they came out, it was like, oh man, like those guys... Shock G is a genius, first of all. I mean, that guy, he doesn't get near the respect he deserves. You know, like, he put Tupac on, you know what I'm saying? Like,
Tupac, go ahead and rock this. Now I clown around when I hang around with the underground. Girls used to frown, say I'm down when I come around. Gas me, and when they pass me, they used to diss me. Harass me, but now they ask me if they can kiss me. Get some fame, people change, wanna live their life high. Same song can't go wrong if I play the nice guy.
Claiming fame must have changed now that we became strong.
I remain still the same, cause it's the same song.
Just Sex Packets is one of those records. Just the amount of influences, you know, or even Ice Cube, like he had humor. Like it was serious, scary ass records. But, you know, like Death Certificate had Robin Lynch and Look Who's Burning. Like he, you know, Gangsta's Fairy Tale. Like rappers weren't one dimensional because even your like Eazy-E was hilarious. Like he was a scary gangster short guy that would shoot you, but he was funny.
Yeah.
A lot of guys who made like, you know, fun, happy records would be the first to punch you in the face. that was just how, you know, De La Soul, P's Pars. They talk about people calling them hippies and they got to turn the club upside down to get some respect.
But my tolerance level has now peaked and now it's time for some heads to get flown.
We bring the peace, of course. But pack a knot inside my De La drawers. A picture painted pink could turn to red and blooded quick. But in a single farm, my native...
So, rappers weren't one-dimensional back then. And like I'm saying, like that... A lot of us grew up on that music, but then by the time we got to the music business, it was like everybody picked a side. It's like, you know, when you're in lunch in junior high school in the cafeteria, you got to pick a section.
Yeah.
Or like in jail, like, yo, am I going to be a 5%er? Am I going to be in this gang? You pick your part. The music business is the same thing. You pick which artists am I going to tour with? Which artists am I going to collaborate with? When I do an album, who am I going to get features from? And everybody respected me. I worked everywhere, but I wasn't ever at home in any.
You never had a crew that you were associated with.
I had my crew.
Yeah, I mean,
I had the Old Made Billionaires, but I never. For instance, I worked with. I did an album self-titled. I did tracks for Apathy. My best friend Metropolis was in the Demigods, but I was never in the Demigods. I worked with Eastern Conference. Demigods and Eastern Conference Weathermen had some problems, and people were trying to put my name in. I'm like, I'm a musician, man. Wherever I can go to, you know, to get my beats heard or my verses, or I can make some money, I'm going to try to make some good music. So I never got caught up in the little cliquishness that was in. I worked with everybody, but then I was never at home with them, you know. And a lot of their hardcore fans didn't like me because I just wasn't part of that aesthetic. Like, I remember when I did the Boss Hogg album, like,
which is great, it's super funny, by the way.
Oh yeah,
it's a great record.
Jay's old, aka Captain. Backslap your bitch, aka Kenny Hoggins.
Yeah.
Tom Jones, a rap. 2006, yeah. Bobby Brown, goddammit.
Uh-huh.
And who are you?
I be self-titled the Rubik's Cuban, aka Wade Hoggs, Captain Crunk, Snout Hoggy Hogg.
Yeah.
Motherfucking Reverend Get Right, the pastor of pimpin'. Bitch.
Pigs are filthy animals. The lames better get in line.
Preach.
So you got the hog to the snout. Show them what you all about or pay the swine fine.
And if a bitch can't swim, she need a rotation device.
People would put songs on YouTube and cut me out. Like, self-titled fans were like, cut me out. And like, me and Self were boys. Like, that's my friend, you know what I'm saying? But it was like a lot of Demigods guys I would read reviews and they didn't like me, but they weren't accustomed to hearing me because my style is different than what App and Self were doing. Like, I was a little bit too quirky for it.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like one guy I always toured with was Lewis Logic because he was another odd duck.
It seems like I'm the devil's riding henchman, but no one on this earth loves all of God's inventions. Not to mention, I got a date to try and talk with Satan and lots of tension because I'm late for my inauguration.
Right this way, Governor Bush.
And he didn't fit anywhere. So me and him were two odd ducks. He was the only guy that I toured successfully with.
Right.
You know, because we were just weirdos. And... but I worked with everybody. I did beats with everybody, but I was never at home with anybody. After my own crew split, I was pretty much on my own. And being a lone wolf in the music business is dangerous. Like, you won't last long if you don't have affiliations. And now it's a little easier because I can go directly to my social media following. Hey, I got this record out. But you're not going to get on any tours. You know, I remember seeing, like, Chuck D, like, he's always hammering the point home on Twitter. Like, an artist has to tour. We want to sit... And, you know, like, I was like, yeah, that's cool. But, you know, touring, you could lose your shit. Touring could kill your morale. If you're not doing it right,
yeah.
It ain't, you know, like back in the days, atmosphere, get in a car and just drive around a region and lock it down. Now it's just so flooded. It's hard to get in. So I had, like, touring really was the first thing that soured me. Doing shows in volume, just thinking that if I just do show after show after show, I'll make an impact. And you play 9-10 shows in a row with two people there, you're not selling merch, the word ain't spreading, there's nobody on the bill that you can latch on to. You know, if I was part of Uncle Howie's thing or the Demigods or the Weathermen or Cunning Linguists, you know, like all these, you know, if I was part of a crew, it might have been easier. But
do you ever regret not doing that? Not saying like, hey, I'm gonna throw in with the Demigods or
I don't regret it though. I don't regret it because musically. Because I remember when, early in my career, the first person to hit me up was DJ Mighty Mai for beats. He was the first person to get one of my Jay's own records and be like, yo. And that's what I wanted to do. I wasn't trying to rap. I wanted to be a producer. What I did with Eastern Conference was what I wanted to do. Like with Pete Rock in the 90s, hit me up for beats. And he was the first person to call me. So he was like, yo, I got Tame One from the Artifacts. I'm like, word, you know, and I got Cage, a word, I got Copyright, I got High and Mighty. And I started doing a lot of beats and I was happy doing that. But then people started saying like, yo, Jay Zone is Eastern Conference. And I had nothing against them. You know, they were cool. We worked together, but I didn't like that because I wasn't part of Eastern Conference, because when I worked with Self-Titled, everybody went nuts because they were like, yo, I used to get emails like, why are you working with the, and I'm like, what is this about? Because they have problems. I got to have problems. So I don't regret that at all. I liked working with everybody, but I didn't want to be, I'm not part of no man's crew. I have my own little thing with Huggy and Al Sheed. That didn't work out. And after that, I was just solo. Like I would work with her, but I don't regret that, because even just by me doing tracks for Eastern Conference as a producer, to this day, people still, you know, they think, and being in the EC All-Stars video, people thought I was in Eastern Conference. And because of that, they start to question like who I worked with. I'm like, y'all take it that serious? Like to me, it was just music.
Right. I mean, that's like pro wrestling.
Yeah. It's like, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's like pro wrestling. And, you know, I didn't want to be, you know, I liked all the guys I worked with. I didn't want to be part of no crew. I didn't want any branding or affiliation on me. I'm Jay Zone. I do what I do. And that hurt me, but I don't regret it. Yeah. You know,
I want to talk about your actual production for a minute, since, you know, we've talked about some of the people you've worked with.
Right.
It wasn't till, you know, by the time a Bottle of Whip Ass, your second album, came out, you kind of had, you could tell like, oh, something that would, you know, your production style was, you could tell what it was. You know, you had hip hop drums, but odd sounds, unusual instruments, a lot of the dialogue samples you were talking about.
Back in elementary, principal pulled me to the side and he said to me,
make me one of them.
And even as a fifth grader, worthless, no purpose, and wouldn't do shit later, tried out.
And then by Sick of Being Rich, which I know is your favorite of your records, it had really bloomed into something like totally distinctive.
I bought Lisa a bracelet and hit it. Now I gotta get it back to the store so the refund I could get it. Don't blow dough on food, so there's none in my fridge. But I stay getting full when I come to your crib. Fuck paying for it.
When did you kind of figure out, like, hey, I have a production style? Or do you think you do? Do you think of your stuff that way?
I realized I had a style. Probably it really hit full stride around Pimps Don't Pay Taxes.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I figured it out. There was continuity starting with the first two records, but by Pimps, I had hit my stride. But like, as an artist, you're never going to want to be pigeonholed.
Yeah.
So people think that's all you can do. And I think with Sick of Being Rich, I was like, I have my trademark elements, like the dialogue bits and the weirdness of the stuff, you know, and the drums. But, you know, I was like, let me try to try it with different sounds, try different things. I just wanted to expand upon it. It didn't get the best reaction. That record wasn't particularly well received. That one and A Job Ain't Nothing But Work. I tried to experiment and add on the sound and do some different things. But people kind of like when they hear I always tell artists now, be sure that the first impression you put out there is one you can live with for the rest of your life. Because as long as your natural life goes, people are going to ask you to go back to that. Like now, people still ask me, like, Pimps, you know, people say, yeah, Pimps Don't Pay Taxes. I was like, I made a lot of records besides that one.
Right. And you kind of mixed. I mean, I know that's a record that people generally think of as like the, you know,
the one,
their
yeah.
favorite, your one. But you have mixed feelings about that record.
Yeah, I do. I think it was a great moment for me because I think I maxed out independently what you could do. I put that out myself and it did very well for an independent record, like with no major, with no marketing. I had no publicist. You know, I'm extremely proud of being able to get that record as far as I did without any media team, no marketing. All I had was like basic bare bones distribution. And I'm extremely proud of that. But the making of the record was just a pain in the ass because, you know, shout out to my man Al Sheed and Huggy. They were my partners up to that time. And it was just, there was some tension there. I'm saying like we weren't even really a group. We were three solo artists that clicked together, but it happened by accident. They got on my first record just for the love and us, you know, in the second album, it was like, damn, people like us together. Let's keep going. But they had musically, they had ideas that they wanted to do. Hug wanted to go in a different direction musically, and so did Sheed. And it was kind of like, well, this is working for us. Why don't I just keep trying to get this thing bigger and bigger so I'm in a position to be a Peanut Butter Wolf or to be a Mighty Maya, where I can go to a distributor.
And you can present artists.
And present you, you know, set you up so you guys can do solo records. Then you can go do your own thing. That was my plan. But after Pimps Don't Pay Taxes, it was kind of like people were kind of wanted Hug and Sheed to continue doing what the records that we were making. But the records we were making weren't necessarily what they wanted to make on their own. Like Sheed at the time was more into like a more street sound, you know, like production wise. And, you know, he could do anything because he's versatile. So could Hug. They could come into my world and rhyme over these weird beats and do these J-Zone joints. But for their solo stuff, that's not what they wanted to do. And when we started working on stuff, I didn't want to stop, you know, I felt like I was hampering their progress, like their vision, because, you know, I would want to, we did a couple of singles together that were successful, but like the distributor and my immediate fan base wanted them to rhyme over my kind of beats and do the records that they did with me. And they were like, no, I want to rhyme over like a beat like this, you know, or I want to talk about this. And there was conflict, and, you know, I was trying to set that up while Pimps was being made. And it was just, there was a lot of tension during that record. It just, it wasn't a fun time. There was just tension. And also we were a lot younger, you know, like I was 23. She was like 21. Hug was like maybe 25 at the time or something. 27, something like that. So, I mean, we were also younger. So, you know, our egos and us just being young and not knowing how to address things properly and letting things boil over, you know, some tension built up. And it's hard to work with tension. I mean, I learned that from watching Leaders of the New School, like when their second album came out and they broke up right on MTV Raps.
And we noticed that the group was having a little powwow over on the side. And we could see that the conversation between Busta and the other members of the group was starting to get kind of heated.
Please don't film this beat.
Busta came over and said, look, Fab, I gotta apologize, man, but we're not gonna be able to do this today.
The group is unraveling before our eyes, you know, and it's on camera. We're rolling camera as the group is falling apart.
Leaders of, it's like when there's tension like that, it's not fun to be in the studio.
Yeah, I mean, was that weird? Like you see that, you know, as a young fan, you're like, well, how could it happen? How could things get to that point? And then all of a sudden you're in a position where things
you're
actually
in a position
get
to that point. And like I said, a lot of it is youth. I'm saying, like, Sheed and I spoke to Sheed yesterday. Like, we're still boys. We still work together. But
he has a great verse on your new record.
So I'm going to get my man Al Sheed to explain it to him why opposites attract. Let's go.
Now, if I say it's going down, it means I'm up to no good. If I'm right on your block, you can't left in your hood. Fucking with me don't make sense. You got dollars to waste. I put something in your grill for coming out of your face to say I'm a real...
Yeah, yeah, he's just... Sheed is just... He's probably the best... out of all the MCs I work with, to me, he's still the best. Like, our chemistry, I can't say enough about how just that guy, I mean, the way his mind works, he's a machine. And Hug's knack for concept, I mean, those guys were great artists.
Yeah.
But we were younger. We wanted to do different things. You know, that I'm trying to get distribution to get that so we can have money to press these records. The distributor wanted something else. So I'm caught between the distributor and my artists. And, you know, none of us want to, you know, I wanted to try to do new things sonically. We all wanted to try new things, but the fans wanted more in the line of Pimps and Bottle of Whoop Ass and Two Madre. We were all wanted to go separate directions. And I was just frustrated. I did Pimps Don't Pay Taxes because I knew that's what people want. I had fun, but I knew that's what people wanted. So I did it, but I was already preparing to try to do new things while it was going on. I was like, how many times can I just like make circus beats and put 5,000 movie clips over it? Like, that's cool, but I want to do other things. I'm, you know, and
yeah. I do have to ask one specific thing about the Old Maid Billionaires, which is like on that Trojan War tune, Huggy, you have Huggy rap a verse from the point of view of your dick.
Right.
How on earth did you sell that to him?
that's one thing. Hug was just down for whatever. Like, he was just a creative dude. He was a hell of a writer. And I was like, yo, this idea, and I just presented it in a way like, yo, man, like, you get to snap on me. You know, like, we just realized how good and we both had lines before about how, like, condoms, like, yo, we always just talk about it, like, yo, man, condoms, like, yo, I was ready to do this shit and fuck with my performance. And we always just talk about it, like, we need to do a song about that shit. and I was like, I was just like, I wrote the rhymes. I was like, yo, you don't have to, but you want to play the role of the dick? He was like, yeah, fuck it, I'll do it. And you know, he stole the show on that. You know, like, he's just a real talent, you know. And back then it was just like, I mean, it was a lot of fun, but then there was just, like I said, there was tension that kind of like was a lining of it. And mm-hmm. and that there'd be a good, it's like a relationship. Like, there's good moments and then there's a bad moment. And I said, a lot of that had to do with just differences and we wanted to go in direction, frustration. It wasn't the most money being made. Because, you know, it was independent and just us being young.
Yeah.
You know,
I guess one other thing I was curious about was like J-Zone, the persona, and you as a person. I've read that like when you started out, you know, in college, when you were making the first record, they were opposites. Right. You were a very shy person. J-Zone was this kind of loud, brash character. Did they kind of move together? As the years went on, like, how did your relationship to the character change?
It's always going to be there because I need humor to cope with disappointment. That's how I cope. Like, I laugh at stuff and, you know, I have strong opinions. So, like, a lot, me creating Chief Chinchilla was my way to get out, like, my innermost crazy thoughts. And as I got older, the J-Zone character is still out, but he's, it's just, I've gotten a little more serious. It's funny, but it's not as slapstick funny. It's more like deadpan funny. So my type of humor changed as I got older because, you know, the Lucy Liu thing and the dick jokes and the stuff, you know, like, eventually you're just like, you have other things on your mind because you're dealing with bills, you're dealing with different things. And it's like, I'll make a smart ass comment and then I'll have the Chief Chinchilla thing to bring that slapstick element to it. So I don't have to put my name on it. So I could still be taken seriously. Because I just found that being a funny artist is difficult. Because people assume that you're not serious about your craft. And that bothered me. That was one thing that always pissed me off. Because it was like, yeah, J-Zone, he's always making these jokes. Ha ha. He's got these little jokey little beats. Ha. And they don't know how many hours I used to put in to, like, looking for records, putting all these things together, like, getting those sound bites off of television, like, listening to VHS tapes for 6 hours while you're doing laundry and doing paperwork, and you hear this, you go get it, find a way to insert. I mean, it was a labor intensive, I was extremely serious about my craft, and it really, really bothered me that when people saw me as a, like, somebody compared me to Bobby Jimmy and the Critters once.
There I was, walking down the street, and these real fine ladies said, come have a seat. I tried to sit down in the chair, and my butt just spreaded it everywhere. I got a beat.
And it drove me up the wall. You know what I'm saying? Because it was like, you know, I'm a serious artist who happens to not take himself too serious, like my, you know, daily life too seriously. And when I realized that I couldn't get out of that, and no matter what, I'd always be that jokey J-Zone with the Lucy Liu and the circus. I left music and then just, I just didn't want to do that. That's, to this day, I don't do shows, my old material. I don't perform. Because I could, but I don't want to sell that. I'm too busy trying. I'm trying to rebuild, and it's hard enough when people are like, "Hey, what's up with Lucy Liu? Hey, what's up? Hey, Jay's. Oh, yeah, Pimp Slap. This, you know."
Right. To the extent they know something about you, it's a 10, 15 year old persona.
Yeah, it's, you know, the 23 year old me was the first impression.
Yeah.
So people, I got my most exposure during that time. So, you know, like, oh, J-Zone, haven't heard that name in a while. Yo, Lucy Liu. I'm like, yo, I talked about her on 2 albums, you know, like 15, 16 years ago, you know, and it was like, I can't run from it. Like, it's always going to be there. So part of my decision to never perform old material was like, it's not like the Rolling Stones where you have these timeless songs you can perform them 50 years later. Like, you feel a little ridiculous in your late 30s performing songs you wrote at 23. Not saying the music doesn't have its timeless element, but to me, those songs aren't, they're timeless for what they are, but they're not timeless in a way where I could still get up and promote and perform those. Like, you know, you couldn't pay me enough money to go back and do No Consequences live. Like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the interesting things about the Live at the Liquor Store album, which is, you know, the album of like malt liquor jingles.
You That's did one
with
of my favorites.
Chief Chinchilla,
yeah.
And Swagmaster Bacon.
And when we drink, we don't drink my rap. I pull up to the store.
Fool, tell them what you get.
Motherfucking St. Ives, 40 ounce silver can. Mix it with sake when I drink in Japan. Bitch asks for a sip. I damn near kill.
Which is a great record, obviously. Like, you know, you grew up loving the West Coast St. Ives jingles.
S-T-I-D-E-S, I'm drinking. Now look, boy, you look at me. I got you thinking about a cool 40, a cold can. What? It makes you want to sing and dance.
Want to go? Don't spare. To the liquor store.
Yeah.
And get some St. Ives, baby. Get some St. Ives.
Yeah.
Do you want to go?
They are phenomenal music, you know, despite kind of being like short and kind of jingle length. But like, yes, it's funny, but it's also like part of the album is this dynamic between you and the Chief Chinchilla character where you're like, I don't really want to promote this. I don't really drink anymore.
Yeah.
And your alter ego is trying to drag you back into it.
Nah, yo, you know malt liquor's poison, man. I ain't selling that to no pregnant women and no kids, man. Word up.
Yo, man, who the fuck gonna be pregnant or a little kid listening to these shits, man? I'll sell malt drink to anybody. I just don't give a fuck, man. Here, sip this shit.
Nah, I don't do that shit no more.
Yo, man. Nah, we just gonna go down.
Yeah, because I did stop drinking. I stopped drinking in 2007. But I love St. Ives commercials. And I had all these crazy thoughts like, yo, if I did these things, they'd be hilarious and they'd be dope. But I don't drink. So I use Chief Chinchilla as a vehicle. You're saying to like sell that, even like on the last album with the player potion thing, I had to get Chief to do that because I mean, I don't drink.
I'm off to the stove for a player potion, more liquor, cold six, fuck. So refreshing.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like I was still able to get my ideas. I was able to make them reality by using Chief. And Chief has like helped me out. Chief Chill, Swagmaster Bacon. Like I'm always going to be silly.
Yeah.
Because I'm like a silly, funny dude. But it was a point where that was damaging. I felt it was damaging me as a producer and as a musician, and as an artist. You know, because you had mentioned other producers and then I was kind of like an asterisk, like, yeah, but is he for real? And that used to bug me, you know? So, and my reputation came before me, like, yeah, Jay Zone, I heard you're a wild man and they never heard my music. And it's like, they're thinking it's like a gimmick or right. something, you know, but part of me, there's always going to be that tussle between the silly side of me and the serious side of me. I just felt I had to create an alter ego to carry the silly side.
So you give the silly side to a 4-foot chinchilla.
Yeah, I gave it to him. So, you know, I was like, here, you take the ball. So when I feel like being silly, I can do it, but it's not a direct reflection on Jay Zone, you know?
Yeah.
Because Jay Zone is what's trademarked, patented, and what the name is. So I'm very careful about what I put my name on at this point.
Sure. I wanted to get into real quick some of the music that actually kind of that I first became aware of through some of your writing, through the book, through Ego Trip.
Mm-hmm.
You're a big supporter of Mobb Style.
I used to jump in my joint and start to dip. Right past the girls and they yell, go whip. I hit them with the horn because they on my tip. Continue the bounce down the street from left to right.
Which yes. Not a ton of people know about. Harlem people that I've met, you know, certainly know about it. I've seen one Mobb Style t-shirt in my life, which I almost stole from the guy who was wearing it.
Oh,
the
man,
cover of the first
shirt.
Album.
Yeah.
So that was a Harlem-based rap group that was one of the members was an actual drug kingpin named AZ
Faison.
AZ
Faison, yeah.
So yes. Why were they important to you?
Well, I first heard of Mobb Style, the Source magazine put out a sampler CD with the 1991 Christmas issue, and it had 16 full songs on it. I guess you labels could pay to get on this CD, and it had everybody from Sir Mix-a-Lot, Hard Knocks, Second to None, Two Kings and a Cypher.
D Dot has been a guest on the show in the past. We've talked to him about the Two Kings and
Cypher. Yeah, wow. Yeah, Del the Funky Homo Sapien. It had like Dr. Bombay on it. It just had like 16 track Godfather Don of all people. Like it had all these songs. And Pretty Tone Capone, Can't Talk Too Long on the Telephone, which never came out. It was unreleased. It was on this compilation and that's it. And I have it. And I remember hearing it and being like, yo, this is the hardest shit I've ever heard in my life. Like the way you, yo, Tone, what's up? Yo, I got, yo. And the beat was hard and don't go nowhere, baby, don't watch your breath. It's just like, it just made, I was like, damn, like this shit is like, there's no finesse.
Hey, yo, Tone. What's up? Yo, I got bait.
What?
Where you at?
On 125th Street.
Yo, I'm in a Jeep with five niggas deep. Stepping correct so your black don't sleep.
Yo, Tone, step fast, cause I'ma kill a nigga's ass. God forbid it, a kid got cash.
Yo, G, don't go nowhere, right?
And that's what I loved about it. Like, Just Ice. Like, I always like brute force rap. Tim Dog, like, where there's no finesse. It's just like, you know, the guy where he's like 250 and just like, coming out of church's chicken with a big greasy bag, like looking for a fight. You know what I'm saying? Like with a baseball bat in the trunk. And I always like that kind of rap just because it's just when you're in a bad mood,
right?
It just makes you feel like better.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who can kind of fake that a little bit, but the people you're talking about are just that all the time.
Yeah.
At least on record.
Yeah, like, and you know, I was like, Pretty Tone Capone, Pretty Tone Capone, Pretty Tone Capone. And I don't know where I read it, but it may have been in the source, like uses the group Mob Style. I was like, Mob Style. And I was in Music Factory on Jamaica Avenue in Queens, in my neighborhood, which is gone. Mr. Walt from the Beat Miners used to work there. And I walked up in there and I saw the Mob Style tape on the wall. I was like, oh shit, he's in this group and they have an album. I was like, let me get that tape there. Unbeknownst to me, like it was probably put in there on consignment by the group. Like they had no distribution. What the tape, executive produced by Vaughn Mason, who I knew from youth because Bounce Rock Skate Roll by Vaughn Mason and crew. I was like, yo, he's an old disco dude. I was like, is this a disco album? I was looking at it, I was like, but they had the drug scale in the front. I'm like, yeah. And the good, the bad, the ugly. And I popped that thing in, man, and I was like, wow. Like it didn't have very good production value, but it was like they had a song called Rough. I play Rough with Gangsta Lou, Pretty Tone Capone, AZ, and they were rhyming over that Isaac Hayes loop. And I remember when Gangsta Lou came, it was like, Gangsta Lou, yo, I grew up rough, shooting, fighting, stabbing, yeah, that started me. Then Pretty Tone, I'm fed up. This is a setup. Nobody move. Shut up, chump.
I'm fed up. This is a setup. Nobody move. Shut up, chump. I got nothing to lose. Pretty Tone Capone, known for torture. If I don't kill you, chump, I'll extort you.
And my dad is actually a rap fan. Even at the time, like most parents hated rap. My dad was into rap. And he was in the car. He was like, this is nice. And like, my pops is like 44 years old. And we're in the car, and he's like, this is tough. It's like, I like this. And I was like, God damn, this Mob Style. I got to find out more about him. And then that summer, they dropped Live and Let Die with the video. And I bought Game of Death, and then Pretty Tone Capone did a bunch of singles on Deaf American with Rick Rubin. He did Kidnapped, Case Dismissed, Kidnap, and then he did Sexy, Mark for the... Then I became a completist for Mob Style because then I realized, like, these guys don't have a major... This was before all that indie rap stuff.
Right, that's the thing, is they were, like, independent in New York.
In New York.
Two things didn't go
and
together,
they had
right?
They had, like, a very small distributor that... I think just by virtue of living in New York, that's how I found it. I think if I didn't live in New York, I would have never found it because... You know, especially that first album. And then the AZ Streetwise, I found that at Hot Wax on Jamaica Avenue. Like right. That, I don't even think that had a barcode. That was just a tape. And I bought everything Mob Style I could possibly find. I had to have it. All the singles, the AZ, the Pretty Tone Capone, everything. And I think just by me being in New York, I was able to find it just because they probably put it there. I think if I was living in Texas, I would have never known, right. You know?
And it's funny that AZ, you know, not, we should be clear, not the AZ, you know, who most people think of as a rapper, but the AZ from Mob Style.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like most people, if anyone knows of him now, it's like, oh, that's the guy from Paid in Full.
Yeah.
AZ Faison is a former drug dealer based in Harlem, New York, who rose to prominence during the 80s. After reportedly earning upwards of $100,000 per week, in 1987, he was shot 9 times when his stash house was robbed. The robbery left 3 dead and 3 injured, including Faison and a 13-year-old girl who was stabbed in the stomach and then shot repeatedly. After the incident, Faison left the drug game behind and tried to steer children away from the path he'd taken. He helped form Mob Style in 1989 and released a solo record in 1991. His life story was eventually turned into the Dame Dash-produced 2002 film Paid in Full, starring rapper Cam'ron, Wood Harris, who played Avon Barksdale in The Wire, and Mekhi Phifer. Faison went on to insist that the film was too positive about the drug game, in spite of its violent ending. Of the film, he said, "It's a good movie, don't get me wrong, but this," holding up the original script called Trapped, "is a masterpiece. This is the Black Titanic."
And they know him as sort of like, oh, I saw this drug, you know, DVD of him.
About crack and drugs, yeah. And he got shot and all this stuff. But they don't know that about this music endeavor.
Right.
That came after when they tried to go legit. And I was, me and my best friend growing up, Kevin, my man Kevin Barty, like we were this diehard Mob Style fan. I remember we were watching HBO one time at my crib and there was a Rikers Island special on and Gangsta Lou was on there.
This area is the processing area for new admissions coming into the system for any inmates that are being transferred in or out.
Hey, yo, what TV is that?
HBO.
HBO? What's up? Gangsta Lou in the house from Mob Style.
All right, Gangsta Lou. They just pick you up this morning?
I've been here since Tuesday.
Not in this little place here.
Man, listen, it's hard as hell, all right?
Me and him went crazy. We were like, yo, Gangsta Lou's in Rikers. Yo. And then I actually interviewed AZ years later for Hip Hop Connection magazine. And it was like, I interviewed him right here in Harlem. I met him and I interviewed and it was like coming full circle. And he called Pretty Tone Capone. Wow. And he was like, I'll let you talk to him. And he was like, yeah, what's up, G? And I'm on the phone and I'm like, yo, can't talk too long on the telephone. Yeah, and you know, I just think like the Tim Dogs and the Mob Styles and the Live Squads. And
Tweety Bird Loke, another one.
He was from Compton. So like that's the opposite thing. Like that would, how would I know about that in New York?
Right.
Like people, like some kid in Compton, Tweety Bird was their Mob Style. But I was the type of kid, I loved rap so much. I would go to Tower Records and look at song titles and album covers and buy things. If I saw a song title that sounded real crazy,
for example, My Dick Is Still Prejudiced.
My Dick Is Still Prejudiced.
My motherfucking dick, bitch, is something you won't get. I don't give a fuck about you, my dick is prejudiced. Still saying fuck a white bitch. And her man be hating him the most. I deserve a motherfucking Grammy. This shit just ain't right, black with white. I respect my mama too much to bring a devil in her sight. She won't ever see them.
Part one and part two are Fuck the South Bronx, This Is Compton. Like, yo, this has got to be funny, at the very least, at least entertaining. So like Ascari X and Tweety Bird Loke and all the rap a lot shit, Too Much Trouble, Gangsta Nip, Big Mello, like all that regional stuff that nobody in New York would ever know about. Like I used to just see, and obviously if you buy one, for instance, I bought, I might've been Raheem, The Invincible on Rap-A-Lot, and I really liked it. And obviously, Willie D, big fan, Ghetto Boy. After that, I said, anything Rap-A-Lot, I'm buying. So then it was Too Much Trouble. It was Gangsta Nip. It was the Odd Squad, which was a total surprise because they could have been from New York. They had like a jazzy kind of a sound, great album. And anything on Rap-A-Lot, Big Mello, The Terrorist, The Convicts, DMG, Choice, you know, Fifth Ward Boys. And I'm in New York and I'm buying all this stuff. Like whenever I would go, because Tower carried regional stuff. The Wiz, not so much. Music Factory, definitely not. But Tower Records was national. So they had it was mandatory for them to carry at least one of everything. So you would get Seattle records like High Performance or Kid Sensation. You would get Miami stuff like Poison Clan. You would get St. Louis stuff like JCD and the Dog Pound or Silk Smooth. you know, in the Rap-A-Lot stuff, Detroit's Most Wanted, you know, like all these regional records. And like whenever, I never bought clothes. I was always dressed crappy. Never, my boy used to give me haircuts. Like I never spent money on nothing but records and gear.
Right.
So anytime I got allowance or I worked an odd job, all my money went to records and tapes. So I like, how are you able to afford to, every week, two tapes, mandatory. Got to go buy two tapes every Sunday. I hang with my dad. We go to Tower or we go to Wiz, J&R, two tapes. Music Factory, two cassettes every week, or a 12-inch and a tape or something. And before long, I had everything. I was like maybe 17 years old, and I had everything. I got photos somewhere of just my wall. I just nailed the things to the wall, and I just, above my bed, like I just had a wall of tape. And then I was DJing then. So that stuff, vinyl took a dip in the early 90s. So labels like East West would only press promos with no picture covers. And a lot of that regional stuff wasn't on vinyl. The Miami shit was, but, you know, like all the Rap-A-Lot stuff, that stuff wasn't really on vinyl. So the New York stuff I had on vinyl or CD, and then all that West, all the other regional stuff I had on cassette.
Wow.
And between tape, CDs, and vinyl, like I had everything, you know.
There was something in your book, I kind of jump topics for a second. You mentioned something that I hadn't thought of, kind of went down, which is like you say like, okay, a teenager who picks up the saxophone today, right? You're 14, you're playing the saxophone. You're going to know who John Coltrane is.
Right.
14, 15-year-old kid picks up the guitar. They're going to know who Jimi Hendrix is.
Right.
14, 15-year-old kid aspiring to rap these days most likely is not going to be able to know Cool G Rap if they bumped into him on the street.
Right.
Why is that? Why is it different for rap?
I think rap is such a youth-driven culture, hip-hop, because it was made to combat our parents. Everything about it was youth-driven. You know, like the Run DMCs of the world used to have to open up for Cameo. They used to perform on a bill with all these groups from the 70s that were damn near cross-dressing. So it was like, that was old hat. And then plus we were sampling their music. Those guys said, you're not musicians. So there was a rift from the beginning. So rap from the beginning, maybe not in the early days with like the Spoonie G's and stuff, but I'd say from Run DMC and on, there was a gap between, I think also because I think guys who were born, I think Generation X, rappers born from like the mid 60s and on, there was a gap between them and, you know, your Gap bands, your Confunctions, they might have grown up listening to that because their parents played it, but then they would get to a point where they would put those funk bands who were on their way out on a bill with Run DMC who was on their way up, and they would clash. Like, you guys only have a turntable, where's your instruments? And yada, 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 yada. Three guys, we got 10 guys, you know, these guys are making money, you know. So there was that riff. So I think, you know, the Jimmy Spicer, the Super Rock, like all that stuff, not so much. But I think once Run DMC came in and you started sampling the older guys and we started hearing profanity on the records, which was new, sexually explicit stories, which was new for being common. Like you had Blowfly, Dolomite records, but, you know, most of it was innuendo up to that point. It wasn't like, yo, suck my dick, bitch. It wasn't like that. I think once the Run DMC era, the LL Cool J era, I think once that came in the mid 80s, we saw a shift in generation. And from that point on, rap has been youth driven. So you're only inspired, like whatever inspires you immediately is your reach. There's no going back to study. And I don't agree with it, but it's just, there's just this thing, even among my own peers, they're like, yo, you're still doing that rap shit, you know what I'm saying?
Well, you have that voicemail from Dick Stallion,
yeah,
on the record.
I mean, you know, you're doing your own thing out there. It's cool, you know. I mean, but some of us, like, we got to do this, you know, this other stuff, this adult stuff, man, you know, growing up and all that. Got responsibilities. So, I mean, I hope it all works out. All right, brother, good luck to you, man. Have a blessed day.
Was that real or was that?
Yeah, I told him to do that. I mean, but we always have discussions about that.
I'm sure it was based on, you know, stuff that was actually going on in his life.
But we've had discussions like that where he said that to me. Like, he doesn't feel that extreme, but he has some of that stuff in that conversation he has said to me, you know, and he's like, he called me up Tuesday. He's like, yo, I'm digging the new 45. Like, he's like, yo, I'm really happy you're playing the drums. Cause like he said, yo, you could do that into older age and you're just finding a new groove musically. And he's like, I really like that. And you know, he's like, there's going to just, you know, you rap here and there, but there's going to be a point where you're not going to want to be 50 and rapping. And he's like, I think it's good that you're getting into composing and playing and different things. And, you know, I would never say you're never too old to rap, but I'm just one person. Like, it's hard to do it when you just feel like there's an elephant in the room.
People will take a meter style instrumental from a, you know, 45, 50 year old more easily than a rap song.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, and like I said, I'm not going to sit up here and comment on my own records and say whether they're timeless or not, but you're not going to see me doing, not that I'm too old, too mature. Nah, it's not that, but I'm just like, I don't want to promote No Consequences or Smurf Syndrome or, you know, like, I'm proud of those records, but at this point in my life, like, me getting up and performing that and telling people, yeah, this is what I have to offer. One side of you is like, it's your job. Shut up. You're a musician. Those are the songs people want. Give the people what they want. Shut up. But it would be different if I was just rhyming. You know, I'm rhyming about certain things and taking certain stances. Like, it's not that I disagree with it, but it's just, I don't feel comfortable. I feel like ridiculous. Like, I feel like, I don't want to talk about this shit. I'm saying, like, I'm proud of it, but I'm proud of it for me being a 23 year old who made that record. At 38, I'm not gonna, people are like, yo, because recently The Purge came out. They're like, yo, they must have stole that from No Consequences. I was like, maybe they did. Maybe they, who cares? You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not gonna get up and perform No Consequences anyway. I think it's just this constant tug of war in your brain. Like, am I too old to do this or am I not too old to do this? Or maybe I do this my way, you know? And I think Master Ace is like one of the few people who figured it out.
And speaking of doing your way, finally, like, I wanted to get to what you're up to now. I know you have a project called Super Black with one of our recent guests, Prince Paul.
Yes.
And Sasha Jenkins yeah, from the Ego Trip Collective.
Mm-hmm.
Or from a bunch of things, I guess. One of which is the Ego Trip Collective. What can you tell us about Super Black?
Well, first, I just want to say, like, I'm still, sometimes I pinch myself to see if it's still real. Like, Prince Paul was, like, one of my biggest, I mean, he gave me the faith to pursue what I wanted to pursue. Like, he made humor, he incorporated humor into production. Like, you could make a funny record without rapping. I realized that because of him. Just the way he utilizes and produces, you know, he was just such a massive influence. And me as a writer, Sasha Jenkins, obviously Ego Trip is, I wound up writing for Ego Trip. So it's just, I just think it's coming full circle. Every day where I look at my bank account, I'm like, damn, man, you can make more money. Yeah. I make myself feel better by saying, like, yo, look at everything that inspired you. Like, you're now a part of it. Mm-hmm. So to look to my left and see Sasha from a writing creative standpoint and to see Paul from a production standpoint on my right, it's like, wow. But it's just something really different. I get to, you know, I'm rapping, but it's like I get to talk about, I mean, it has some of the kooky, funny, silly Jay's own stuff, but I also get to tackle some serious issues. I get to, you know, I played drums on the record and rhymed, and Sasha played bass, and Paul just kind of like took our, me and Sasha had 4 hours of jam sessions, and Paul chopped it all up and turned it into, like he found 4 hours worth of old records and just chopped it up into hip hop style and just produced the hell out of it. And we made, you know, the song just about dating in New York. It's a concept album about dating in New York. It deals with gentrification. It deals with race. It deals with class and how all that factors in to dating. You know, because I spent like a few years on OkCupid and I got so many stories just from like going out with, you know, like the gentrification stuff, the race and class, all the different stereotypes that people have that people carry around, and the girls with the headshot, like they only show you their face and then they're like 400 pounds, but you'll never know it until you get there. You know, like all those funny stories, but then there's some elements of seriousness and commentary underneath it. And just, you know, like I said, like mixing it down, like I had to pinch myself, like, yo, I'm in Prince Paul's house and mixing this shit down. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's no amount of money that can replace that,
yeah.
You know, and like, it's just, to me, it was just amazing.
I look forward to hearing that. You also scored or helped to score Sasha's film, right? His film about hip hop fashion. And,
yeah, Fresh Dressed.
Yeah.
Paul had done some stuff and then he got real busy. And then Sasha, obviously being a group, was logical. Sasha made the call. He knows I can play some instruments. I'm a drummer and I can play a little bass. I can play some keys. So he hit me up and he knows that I understand production from a lot of different eras. So obviously chronologically, the movie moves from the 70s to the present. So I know how to make 80s Marley Marlish beats. I know how to make early 80s drum machine beats. I know how to play drums so I can get you that 70s incredible bongo band style stuff that was big then.
The majority of hip-hop artists really just dress b-boy style, where you got on the Lees and you got on the Pumas and a BVD tank top, you know, with your gazelles and Kangol.
And then the 90s, the jingle bells, the filters, and the echoed horns, that, you know, the DITC style stuff. So, you know, whether we're talking about motorcycle, talking about the Black Spades in the 70s, or we're talking about Walker Wear Carl Kanai in the 90s, or we're talking about Dapper Dan in the 80s, I was around for all of it, and I have enough musical vocabulary to be able to create that stuff. So, you know, I worked with Sasha and Noah Rubin. The three of us just worked together. I did some stuff on my own, and, you know, the four of us, you know, scored the music, and I'm proud of it. You know, it came out really cool. I didn't do all the music, but I did a good chunk of it. And that was really cool, you know.
Were you working to the film?
Yeah, they gave us like clips of the film, and, you know, they said this time code, this needs music. And I would just think about something to come up with, and, you know, I had a little bit of experience with scoring, you know, but then like I also...
Well, you scored an imaginary film for one thing.
Yeah, imaginary thing. And I did music for a porno. A lot of people know. But I didn't see that. I just made the music blindly and gave it to them. But in college, I did something for a play. Mm-hmm. I'm just good at like capturing atmosphere. I've always been kind of good. I've done like TV commercials and stuff.
Yeah. The imaginary film, was it To Marry a Hooker?
To Love a Hooker,
To Love a Hooker. Yeah, it's a great, great record.
Thanks, man. Yeah, like that was one of the ones where it was just like I was on my way out, and it was like I was last dying breath to come up with new things, and, you know, it didn't catch. But people who like that record really like it. So
you said you were super depressed when you made that.
Yeah, I was very depressed. That experienced. I made those two albums in a month, two instrumental albums in a month. Really depressed. I was having some health problems at the time. And, you know, I have made a shitload of money doing a Super Bowl commercial.
Sprint lets me download music whenever I want. I have a song for everything.
What if your girlfriend dumped you? Baby, come back. What if you won the lottery? Got cash in the bank. What if your couch caught on fire?
There's a small part in that commercial where they say, What song would you play if you won the lottery? And then you hear 1.5 seconds of my voice saying, cash in the bank, cash in the bank. That was all they used. And that was a $30,000 check, which kept me alive. But, you know, the Boss Hog, the reaction to Boss Hog, that's one of those records like 20 years from now to be like a cult classic. But at the time, it just wasn't doing well. Like, me and Self were supposed to tour and we couldn't tour. You know, things fell through. And that was when, like, 06 was when, you know, at that time, like, Tower Records closed. All the brick and mortars were closing. iTunes wasn't around yet. YouTube was still in its infancy. And none of us had any idea of what to do. I'd say 04, 05, 06, 07 was no man's land for an artist, especially an independent artist, because we had no outlet. So all we knew was, hey, maybe I should press 3,000 copies of this CD, because that's what I always did. And you sell 800 and you got 2,200 you got to destroy. Because, you know, oh, Tower Records is closed. We got 500 returns at the warehouse. Hip Hop Site just shut its doors. you know, this record store closed. Mr. Bongo in London, no more. You know what I'm saying? Like, everything would close down. And it was like, there was no iTunes. There was no YouTube. So YouTube was still new. So we couldn't really do videos. We had no way to market. All we had was MySpace pages and a gang of merch. You know, so like that record, just like the fact that I had to destroy it, and, you know, I was just lost during that time. I was like, what the hell am I doing? Like, what is the next thing? I had no, and then rap was changing over. Like, it was getting younger and younger. And this was before I realized that rap's generational and You don't have to follow what's going on. You don't have to like what's going on, but you shouldn't bash it either. It's just not for you. You know, like, yo, what about this record, this rapper? See a lot of guys on Facebook doing posts in all capital letters. Yo, fuck that, son. Real hip hop. These dudes is dressing like this. Yo, and it's like, that was me 5 years ago. Now I'm just like, you know what? It's not for me. You know, like, I have my own thing. As I get older, it's going to get smaller and smaller and more potent, more diehard fans, smaller. Never going to be a star, but that's fine. You know what I'm saying? But around 2006, you know, you have Just Blaze here, Pete Rock here, Large Professor here. Yo, your shit is dope. Yo, why aren't you get? You should be getting more love. And you start believing that, thinking that it's about the music when it's about other things. You know what I'm saying? Like, me being pigeonholed, me being comedic, me not fitting in anywhere, not being able to tour, like, all these things came into play, you know, and I was like shooting in the dark after a while, just putting out records, just hoping something sticks and expecting these great results because the music is, you think the music is good when it really has nothing to do with that. And, you know, that was like a dark period, like 2006, 2007. That was.
And so finally, other than the Super Black stuff, what are you up to right now? You just released the Time for a Crime Wave.
Yo, this city needs a crime wave. Yes. Sex and balance. To give a chick like this a fresh set of calluses. I ended the date because with a palaver, I couldn't be bothered.
So what you do?
So I robbed her.
Well, yeah, I'm going to try to continue this 7-inch series because people seem to like those. And they give me a chance to stretch out. I've always been such an album guy that I'll make something and be like, damn, that doesn't fit in the theme of the album, and I'll throw it out. When you're doing these little 45s, you could have two random great ideas and they can stand on their own on the 40. They don't have to be in theme. Like, I remember reading a review of Peter Pan Syndrome, and they were like, why did I put Mo Pork at the end of the record? And I was like, I can't not put this on the album. Like, this shit is funny, and it's just... And I just said, if I put it on at the end, it's kind of like a bonus track. But then, you know,
you actually call it a bonus track.
It is, but yeah, I knew it didn't really fit on the album. But yeah. I was like, damn, I really want this on the album. I was like, so I tried to dress it up as like the album ends, and then we kind of like, it's a last dive attempt for us to be current.
I'm sitting up here watching you make all this Renaissance bullshit ass rap. What you need to do is get current. Make you some trap shit, baby. I got some talent. I got this cat named Swagmaster Bacon.
Swagmaster Bacon? Are you serious?
Trust me. You need to be current. Check this cat out.
What the?
Yo, man. Just trust me on this one. You know what? Yo.
You know, and so I set up like that. But then, you know, people review the album and like, you know, this is unnecessary, you know, but it was like when you're doing a 7 inch with two songs, you could do a Mo Pork and then you could do a Molotov Cocktail on the other side. It's not like it has to be in the theme of Peter Pan Syndrome. Like, so I'm such an album guy. Everything I make is in a theme of something. So I'm like, let me see how it feels to just make two good records and pair them. Never done that before. I've always been an album guy, never been a single guy. So like, let me see how, and it's just liberating. You know, you can make two great things and, you know, things you feel are great and they don't have to be that. One could be vocal, one could be instrumental. You know, one could be really fast, one could be really slow, and you kind of like make it its own release. You don't have to, it doesn't have to fit under this umbrella of whatever the theme of the album is. Oh, that doesn't fit. You know, so the single format has been kind of liberating, so I'll continue that. I'm going to probably do a follow-up to Lunch Breaks. I've been doing studio drumming for Danger Mouse. Mm-hmm. I played on a bunch of sessions for him, probably one up on Pop Records, so hopefully that'll get me some shine from the drumming standpoint. I play with a couple of bands. I'm learning how to get out of playing breaks and playing stuff for the studio to just play with other musicians. I think that's the next step in being a drummer, is just making everybody feel comfortable and just keeping the time.
What kind of acts?
Well, the guitar player from the Tom Tom Club, his name is Pablo Martin. He's been my mastering engineer for every record except my first. And you know, the drummer wasn't showing up and they called me to fill in when I had first started playing. you know, I was like, oh, I'm not ready to play yet, you know, but they just kind of had faith in me, and they just, I learned as I was playing with them, and we play everything from rock to, you know, like pop, like just stuff that I don't normally play. We play some funk, but like they have me playing like, like that rock stuff. And it's just been an education, like playing, and I'm playing with a real solid bass player. Like a good bass player will make a drummer whip right into shape because you guys form that pocket. And then it's like, once you lock in, you let all the melodic instruments do whatever they want.
Right.
And I just think the discipline, like I learned how to play these funky beats and these fancy fills and make the drums sound good. But I'm like, yo, just making music that feels good. Don't do nothing fancy. Just be disciplined enough to push it along and hold that time. Like, it's been a hell of a learning experience. We play once a week. We play for like 3 or 4 hours in Brooklyn. We just jam. And, you know, that's just been great for me because eventually, you know, it's like playing with a band. Or like, you know, I think I played drums. I did all the drums for the new Stretch and Bobbito documentary. Mm-hmm. Shout out to DJ Ellie, who scored that documentary. They wanted like drum breaks and stuff. And, you know, I did session work there. They put me with an upright bass player. I did. So, I mean, I'm learning as I'm going, but this is, I'm excited because this is an education to open up a new door. And I can always take these skills and use them to make 45s, make Jay's own records, make breakbeat records. But there's just something liberating about playing with other musicians, because when I was a kid playing that bass, that's what I always wanted to do. I got into hip hop because it was easier for me. I couldn't find a band.
Finding 9 other people.
Yeah, so hip hop was the most logical thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's almost like I feel like I'm 9 years old again, and I'm back on my original path of just playing. And I have hip hop experience, so now I feel like I can express myself in a lot of different ways. I can play with a band. I could do sample stuff. I DJ a lot. I can write. You know what I'm saying? So like, to me, it's just a journey. Like, how many skills can I pick up and try to master, and how many different types of people can I work with? So I feel like creatively I'm in a good place.
That seems like a great spot to end. Thanks a lot for coming through.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
A fan of the show had suggested J-Zone as a possible guest via Twitter a while back, and I'm so glad they did. Just the first few minutes of this conversation, talking to him about funk basses, drum breaks, and mistakes in old JB's records, was some of the most fun I've had on this show. I've also gotten into a lot of music from reading Jay's column on Ego Trip's website. It was a blast to get to talk to the man himself about them, especially Mob Style and Tweety Bird Loc, the latter of whom I spent all week trying, mostly unsuccessfully, to spread the gospel of to some friends. And of course, talking to J-Zone about his own career was edifying. It was a unique experience to talk to someone who was, in a sense, stuck in the middle. Not serious enough for the underground, too weird for the mainstream. And I don't know about all of you, but I can't wait for that Super Black album. Join us next week when we talk to legendary photographer Jeanette Beckman. She shot your favorite album covers, publicity stills, and even that picture of LL with the boombox. You can find The Cypher on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this week's show, ideas you have for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. You can find all of our shows online for free at our website, thecyphershow.com. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes, and make a donation at patreon.com/thecyphershow. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
People want to know what they're dealing with so they don't have to spend time getting to know you or accepting that it's something different.
This show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I worked with everybody, but then I was never at home.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Crappy EDM. It's not like the Rolling Stones where you have these timeless songs you can perform them 50 years later. Like,
we'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
every generation, it's such a youth-based thing, and it just frowns so bad on aging. They tell you you can't rap over the age of 30. Like, what are you still doing rapping over the, you know? So you can't help but just, like, shut down. Like, you know, like, part of the reason I don't think it's right, but, you know, part of the reason I'm going at the drums hard is because I know when I'm 50, I can sit there in a club and play my drums and no one's going to care. 50, I get up and try to rap. It may or may not go over well. Some guys like Master Ace have been able to pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Some guys, you know, they'd be like, get this guy a wheelchair, get him off of here.